SNL Friday Night Speaker Meeting held at El Paseo Shopping Center, Room 120 in San Jose, California, on July 22, 1994. Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Val C. of Campbell, California. The one-hour speaker is Jerry M. of Pacific Grove, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
A minute. Okay. I'm a rambler. Well, I'd like to welcome everyone tonight. I'm Val. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know what? I was just kind of sitting there, not trying to think about what I was going to say, but asking God to use me as a channel. And I just got kind of overwhelmed with gratitude tonight, that I'm clean and sober and that everybody else in this room is here. You know, whether you're clean and sober right now or not, I encourage you to keep coming back. Real briefly, I always felt like I should have been born on another planet. This Earth thing just didn't do it for me. I mean, from since I can remember. I always felt those characteristic alcoholic feelings of terror, bewilderment, despair, frustration, not a part of. And that was from real young. I lacked the capability to form a partnership with another human being, including myself. And thus I was in constant conflict with everyone and everything around me. And that was motivated by a lot of pride and a lot of anger. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic. It doesn't really matter to me. All I know was that I was totally awed by the effect that alcohol produced in my system. I remember my first drink. And I had been quite a behavioral problem to my parents for a long time. And at about 14 years of age, they had had enough. And, you know, I was living on the streets a lot and would use their house to crash and steal money from them and kind of recover after big binges. And I remember even at that time, you know, I'd get these little glimpses of clarity out on the street and think, my God, how did I end up like this? You know, this is not what I'm supposed to be. This is never what I wanted to become, but here I am. And I remember going back to my parents' house after one incredible binge, and begging with them and pleading with them that and telling them that I would change if they would just let me back in. I promised I'd go to school and I'd be good and I'd let my hair grow out because I had this thing about shaving my head. Well, it scared people and I liked that, you know. And so they made a bargain with me and they sent me back to a dude ranch in Wyoming and. It was really tough work. You know, I worked like 15-hour days, and I cleaned up horse poop, and I brushed horses, and I did all that dude ranch stuff. And you know, it was really interesting because though I was terrified of where I was, and it took a lot of hard work, which I didn't like. There were some people back there, and they were called cowboys, and I liked them, man. Because they were tough and they were powerful and they didn't take any crap, you know, and their skin was like leather and they were tan and they rode the range and they had no roots and they were just, God, there was something that attracted me to them. And, you know, it's interesting how the alcoholic mind works, but I associated with their power and all of them were hard drinking, hard riding range drivers, you know, and I associated their power with alcohol. And it's just interesting how we think, man. It's really interesting. So I got this bright idea that to be like them, to be respected, to be honored, to be not taken advantage of, I would do the things that they did, and I proceeded to do that. And my first drunk came about two weeks into me being there. You know, I had no parents, no guardians, no nothing to watch over me, so I pretty much had a free reign after I was done from work. And I one night sneaked in. We had a full bar, and I sneaked into the full bar after I got off work, and I proceeded to take a look at every single bottle in the cabinet, and I took every bottle out, and I poured it in a 32-ounce tumbler. You know, I had things like vermouth and Bacardi 151, and I mean, just this incredible mix of alcohol. I'm surprised I didn't blow myself up, but I proceeded to drink it. And you know what? I drank it till I was drunk. And I can honestly tell you that I adored the way that it made me feel. You know, long story short, I was an alcoholic from the gate. I was a blackout drinker. Towards the end, I drank every single day. There was not a moment that went by that alcohol wasn't part of my life. You know, I had found that magic elixir, that solution to the hatred, the fear, the insecurity, the anger, the pain. I had found it. Alcohol seemed to transform me and make me into this beautiful, charming, witty, lovely woman that people appreciated, you know. That's the illusion that alcohol gave me. And you know what, I can honestly tell you that it became real ugly real fast, yet I proceeded to chase that illusion. I proceeded to chase that eternal buzz, and I can tell you what, you know, it wasn't 2 years into drinking that I could never get the right mix. You know what, after that first drunk, it was just never the same again. Granted, I had a blast for part of my drinking, but it just was never the same. And it seemed like every day that I lived, and the more I drank, and the more I tried to get that just right combination where I was just okay, I couldn't reach it. You know, it eluded me. You know, and that's the insanity of the disease. You know, I knew a long time ago that alcohol caused me a lot of problems. You know, that alcohol was destroying my life and the people's lives around me. Yet I did not stop. I couldn't stop, and the book talks about that. And if you're new, I want to tell you something real quick. If you have the disease of alcoholism, it's a disease that centers in the mind. Yet when we take a drink of alcohol, our body experiences a thing called the phenomenon of craving. And with my experience, I had no way of knowing what was going to happen to me after I drank. Okay? I came to Alcoholics Anonymous at 21 years of age. I had been in and out of the rooms, yet had been totally unwilling to read the book, to get into service, to get a sponsor, to take the steps. I just kind of wanted it to be given to me. You know? And that didn't happen. well, paradoxically, it did happen. And I'll explain that. came to Alcoholics Anonymous at 21 years of age, and I had a near-death experience, and I don't really have time to go into that tonight, but it was the most singular, most powerful experience in my entire life. And you know what? Basically, you know, it was the step before the step for me. I got to that point where I had that moment of clarity, and I had a spiritual experience. And it was revealed to me that I could go on until the bitter end, blotting out the my intolerable situation, or I could do something different. And you know what? That night was so powerful because I was faced with death. You know, for the first time in a long time, I could see reality. And you know what? That didn't happen of me. I honestly believe in my heart that a power greater than myself, whom I choose to call God, gave me one last chance. I ended up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of God, I was introduced to a very powerful, loving, God-centered woman who became my sponsor. And this woman, out of love, took me through the steps and through the traditions and through the concepts of service and through the book. And you know, my God, I just think about her and I just get overwhelmed. My whole life, people have been trying to tell me, you know what, Val, you keep doing what you're doing and you're going to die. And you know what, you're not pretty. And you're not having fun. And I would just get angry. You know, I've had authorities, I've had family members, I've had everybody under the sun who I came in contact with. Even the people I used to use with, my God, that's insane. Used to tell me, God, Val, you need to clean your act up because the way you're going, you're going to die. You know what I want to tell you is that Nobody has ever touched my heart like that of another alcoholic, you know. Debbie had something special about her. I now have another sponsor, but she's a big part of my life. See, she knew where I came from. And she wasn't afraid to listen to me. See, I scared a lot of people out there. And that was my intention. But this woman wasn't afraid. Okay, and I could look in her eyes and I could see that she listened to me. And she cared. And she was concerned with my welfare. And that she wanted to help without asking anything in return. You know, and that was really bizarre because where I come from, people don't do that. You know? And she gave me the gift of showing me, helping me through these beautiful tools that we've been given in order that I could find a relationship with God. You know? The first step for me was to admit powerlessness over my alcoholism. You know? That was the first step. And I tell you what, it's been an incredible journey. I'll have 3 years in September, and I am just in awe about the changes that have gone on in my life. You know, these steps, from what I understand and from what I've been taught, is that, you know, I have a tremendous ego. And my ego has blocked me from the sunlight of the Spirit. See, and in step three, actually in step two, I come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And in step three, I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of Him, as I understand Him. And you know what? These steps have enabled me to get my ego deflated just enough to feel the power and the presence and the love and the grace of God. And in that process, slowly but surely, and little by little, the chains that have bound me, the chains that have been self-constructed, have been lifted. They're not all gone. You know, there's work to do. This is a program of action. You know what? But I'm here. And if you're new, I want to tell you that my life is so good today. God has blessed me with these incredible women to pass this wonderful gift on to. You know, I'm a free woman today. You know, I'm not under in that self-constructed prison anymore. You know, I don't wake up every morning. The first thing I thought is, my God, I need a drink just to survive. Okay? And that's powerful for a drunk. That is damn powerful for a drunk like me. I want to read something really quick and then I'll close. And this comes from step 12. And it's in the 12 and 12. And I just love this because this is what I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the big book is so eloquent and it does a much better job of saying things as they really are than I do. So when a man or a woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he is really going somewhere, that life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength which in one way or another he had hitherto denied himself. He finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love of which he had thought himself quite incapable. What he has received is a free gift, and yet usually, at least in some part, he has made himself ready to receive it. I'm out of time. I just want to thank you all for being here tonight. Thanks, Kev, for asking me. It's been an honor and a privilege. And you know what? If you're new, I just really strongly encourage you to keep coming back because it works. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jerry, and I am absolutely, without question, an alcoholic. And I want to welcome the new people, the 9 people that stood up. And if there's anybody here that didn't stand that's new, that's all right, too. I want to welcome you also. I want to welcome you to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I have the privilege and honor of doing this evening is to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. As I have experienced that, sober, since February the 13th, 1977. That's actually 17 years, 5 months, and 9 days. But who's counting? I used to hear over and over again in Alcoholics Anonymous, that may not impress you, but it impresses the hell out of me. And it impresses a lot of people that I grew up with, and a lot of people that prayed that I would find some way to overcome my drinking, that somehow I might be able to overcome the incredible experiences that you and I have whenever we're drinking, and some of the bizarre behaviors that I experienced in my lifetime while drinking and hurting others and hurting myself. But before I forget, I want to thank the people that made this trip possible. The speaker getters of your group is a wonderful group. I've known about your group for some time. I want to let you know that I live on the peninsula in Pacific Grove. I go to meetings all over the peninsula, but my home group is the Mighty Muffins group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Carmel Valley on Saturday and Sunday morning. It's an 8 o'clock meeting. So that if you're ever on the peninsula, my last name is McDonald, by the way. You won't find Jerry in the phone book. But if you're over on the peninsula and you'd like to go to a meeting, I'm in the book, Jerry McDonald in Pacific Grove, and I'd love to take you to my home group if you're there on a Saturday or a Sunday. And we meet at 8 o'clock in the morning at the community church in Carmel Valley. So I hope you'll come and join us. You're welcome. I met a new friend, too. I'm sitting next to Tammy, who's with us this evening. Person who's coming here, whether it's for the first time or not, isn't important. But she announced herself as a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous in their first 30 days of sobriety. And whether you're here and have been here before really doesn't matter. You're home. You're home. The competition is over. That's what they told me. The competition is over. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, my first sponsor told me, Jeep, he said, and my nickname was Jeep. I'll tell you more about that. One time they told me I'd never be able to stay sober if I kept the name Jeep. But I'll tell you about that too. But he said to me, Jeep, Alcoholics Anonymous is a step up, not a step down. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a happy program, not a sad program. As a matter of fact, when we go through this textbook of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to find that it repeats over and over and over again, and some places very, very specifically, that we absolutely insist upon enjoying life. And that if you've come here and you think it's all over, you're absolutely right. The misery is all over. And we're going to begin a journey that was begun by many people before you. And it's your responsibility if you stay. And I hope you'll stay. I was thinking as the nine people stood up, I wish we could all hang out together for the next year. You nine and me. And just hang out. And every place I go, come with me. That's how they taught me to sponsor people. I said, well, what do I do? They said, just come hang out. And when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's how it began for me. Already getting dry mouth. Incredible how this happens to me. Every time I do this, I say, God, when will the butterflies leave? And they leave and then come back. And what I found out that's normal. But I do this because my sponsor tells me that whenever I'm asked to share at any level of Alcoholics Anonymous, one-on-one, in my home group, with a small group after the meeting for coffee, when I have the privilege and honor of speaking at a speaker's meeting, are you kidding me? Me? And he said, yes. It talks about it in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about you can't keep it if you don't give it away. And the most selfish thing that I can do is not to participate. Thank you. How about that? I got some over here, and I got some under here. What he doesn't know is I've got one sitting over here. I've got one sitting here. Now, that's the way I used to drink. I absolutely could not finish a bottle of beer without having another beer waiting. Absolutely impossible. Guys say, the bartender say, well, you already got one. I said, I know, I need another one. And I was just pouring the first one. It's called a backup. Alcoholics love backups. Everybody's got to have a backup. Sometimes we take that too far. We need to have a backup in relationships. We need to have a backup in jobs. We need to have a backup in money. And on and on and on and on and on. And then we come to Alcoholics Anonymous and we find that those backups in those kinds of contexts are not very spiritual. And then slowly but surely, we have to give up those things that were our old ideas and our old experiences that we brought into this program with us, that if we're not able to do something about them with the people that we love and care about in Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God as we may understand God, then surely they're going to be an anchor for us as we begin to trudge the road of happy destiny. I don't know how I got on all that. Probably because that's what I've been thinking. Or that's what's coming out. You know, when I was sitting there before coming up here and listening to the first speaker, by the way, if she's not here, thank you. She's here. Thank you so much. I was thinking, God, just, I really don't know how this is going to come out. And I was sharing with Perry and Diana, it's really quite simple if you think about it, Jerry. We share our experience, strength, and hope. Our stories disclose in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. So why don't I do just that? My name is Jerry McDonald. I am an alcoholic, and I am from an alcoholic family. I don't blame my family for my alcoholism. But I am from an alcoholic family. I'm from an Irish Catholic Democrat family. Who were railroaders and coal miners and union people. Makes for a lot of defiance. I love defiance. My mother and father were both alcoholics. My brother is alcoholic. My brother lives in a little town up in the northeast corner of Pennsylvania called Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That's where I grew up. I experienced what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous about the gates of insanity or death with this illness that kills just about everybody that's got it in my own family experience. My mother ended up in a county home as a direct result of her alcoholism. That might not mean much to you if you're not familiar with county systems, et cetera, et cetera. It's a home where you go if you ain't got no money and you're beyond in your age. That kind of home. And my father ended up in a mental institution as a direct result of his alcoholism in Warren State Hospital in the state of Pennsylvania. In Warren, PA, and died there as a direct result of his alcoholism in lockup. Lockup. I had heard when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous about this disease and about this illness and about this gates of insanity or death. Crap. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Matter of fact, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, quite frankly, I came here because the heat was on. I don't know if any of you had that experience of coming to this program because the heat was on. I don't know if any of you are experiencing your moments in Alcoholics Anonymous right now because the heat is on. But even if the heat's on, that's okay. Because if you stay here long enough, regardless of what they tell you, it's a contagious illness. You will get the disease of alcoholism if you stick around these rooms. Even if you don't think you got it now. Even if you don't think such a thing exists. Because slowly but surely, I began to understand. And my hope is that if you're new, that you'll begin to understand. That we're dealing with a killer illness. I used to visit my mother while I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before she passed away at that county home in Erie, Pennsylvania. And what I'd like to share with you that is so incredible about this illness is, in those homes, by the way, you live with another person. There's two people in there. Everything you own is in a wall locker. Maybe a foot locker at the foot of the bed and a wall locker and a few pictures. You might share a television set. And I remember her saying to me, Jerry, she always called me Jerry. My father always called me Jeep. I don't know if that's the reason I'm an alcoholic or not, but I'll tell you about that Jerry Jeep thing as we go along. But she said, sit up here on the bed with me. So I'd sit up on the bed with her, and she would say, Jerry, I never thought my life was going to end up like this, ever. And I thought about that since she's passed away, and I've heard it many times in rooms like these and in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we never thought, in whatever experience we had with drinking, that our lives might end up with whatever desperation brought you to this room or to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I learned firsthand out of that experience the incredible devastation of this illness. But that isn't the way it always was. I grew up in this family that ended up in that particular way, with a mother and father who were drinking all the time. And I was known till I was 42 years old. My nickname was Jeep. And that's because I have a brother, Tank. That's the truth. My brother is 5 years my senior. And if you have alcoholic parents that are out at the bars all the time, by the way, my parents were bar drinkers. My brother and I used to hide under their bed when all hell was breaking loose and say we would never, ever drink. Guess what? Not only did we drink, we were bar drinkers. But we had a lot of experience because we would hang around the bars, if you've ever had this experience, with your parents or with a parent. And I'll tell you, it was instant Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, pinball machines, potato chips, pretzels, hard-boiled eggs, pig's feet, pig's knuckles. That was the diet of the McDonald family at the local pub. I knew every pub in town, and I knew every bartender in town. And in those days, there were no ladies permitted at the bar. As a matter of fact, you talk about segregation. Women had to enter bar areas or establishments serving alcohol. This is in the state of Pennsylvania, through a side entrance. Or it would say ladies and couples. And that's where you had to drink your booze. By the way, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, I can't be alcoholic. All I drink is beer. Lots of it. I can remember on occasion, very few occasions, but on occasion, we would somehow get around to talking about my father's drinking in particular and my mother joining my father. By the way, my mother never drank or smoked a cigarette until she was 24 years of age. And our family, as I look back now, that was one of the classic cases where people of one partner may have the illness and is an active drinker and out doing whatever they do, especially if you're a bar drinker, and the other person, in desperation to salvage the relationship, joins the other person. And guess what? Now, instead of one alcoholic, we had two. And later on in their drinking, they would even separate in their drinking and go their separate ways to whatever bars, etc., etc. Anyhow, what I'd like to share with you about that experience is that those were the days where we didn't hear the word codependence or co-alcoholic. But I'll tell you one thing. I was codependent and co-alcoholic before I ever became alcoholic. And I'll tell you how I was and how I know that. When my parents were out drinking, I knew every bartender in town. I knew every telephone number of every bar in town and all the clubs. And in Pennsylvania, it was really something if you're an alky to belong to a club. You almost had to belong to a club to survive because they didn't sell any booze on Sundays and only the clubs sold booze. So my parents were members of the Moose Club, of the Eagles, of the Sons of Italy, of the VFW, of the American Legion. All those veterans organizations. My father was never in the service. I was, but he wasn't. My brother was, but he wasn't. At any rate, I knew all of these people. I knew all these places, and I knew them by name, and I knew them by face, and I knew them by voice. Here's how I know about my codependence or my co-alcoholism. Call it what you will. I call it sicko. But the devastation of this illness is with everybody who touches the person who has it. It's truly a family illness. I would call up, and when that person answered the phone, that bartender, before one, if I was able to get my parents, usually they would lie. You ever have the bartender or people there lie for you? I vowed I would never do that, too. And then I would say, if I get any calls, I'm not here. Not knowing that where I was drinking, the car was right out in front of the place, and anybody that drove by could see that my car was there, including my family. But at any rate, I would call. And if I was lucky enough to get either one of them on the phone, if I was lucky enough, before one half syllable of one word was out of their mouth, I knew whether they were drunk or not. Now, here's the identification. You may identify with this, you may not. I don't know. It's my experience. When they were drunk, I had a knot in my stomach that you would think was an ulcer as big as your fist. And when they weren't drinking, it was clear. It was clear. I spent most of my time growing up trying to get a handle on my parents drinking. Not on mine. On theirs. Later, I was to try to find out how to get a handle on mine. And so I did what a lot of people do. I got out of there as soon as I could. But I want to tell you a little bit about growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they talked a lot about the spiritual side of this program. And I wanted to tell everybody, I went to church all of my life. Matter of fact, I used to go to church and pray and pray and pray. And by the way, I don't know if you identify with this either. It's not unusual for some people from alcoholic families. I used to bite my nails to the quick. Sometimes my hands were a bloody mess. Frankly, I was a neurotic mess is what I was growing up. But anyhow, I forgot where I was now. Oh, one of the things that was a problem is that my parents were a mixed marriage. Now, you have to remember, in the context of the time frame in which I grew up, a mixed marriage in those days for them was my father was Catholic and my mother was Protestant. That was the mixed marriage. You didn't do that. So, I was baptized Presbyterian, churched Methodist. I converted to Lutheranism at age 16 because they had the best baseball and basketball teams in the church league. And at age 20, I converted to Catholicism. Now, those four experiences alone might lead you to believe why I'm alcoholic. But that's not why I'm alcoholic. I don't know about first drinks. I hear people talk about they were 6 months old, 3 weeks old. It's incredible how people can recall when their first drinks were. I think mine was when I was with the people that I ran with. I was an Irish Catholic running with all Italians. It's like my best friends were Putt-Putt Badali, Funzi Constantine, Fuzzy Fazio. And Fuzzy Fazio's father was the huckster. Now, in those days, they had a huckster that would go down through all the streets of your little town, and they would sell like you see at a stand, a roadway stand today, and they'd ring a bell, and everybody would come out in the street, and they'd buy their sweet corn, peppers, and whatever they were buying. But Fuzzy Fazio's dad also made wine. And Fuzzy Fazio's dad's wine was in the cellar. And Fuzzy Fazio's dad's wine was called Dago Red. Now, in those days, I can say Dago today, but in those days, you couldn't call an Italian a Dago, I'll tell you. But it was okay to call the wine Dago Red. And we would drink Dago Red wine. That's my first recollection. It was terrible. It wasn't sweet. It was just terrible. And then all the rest of the drinking was really around my parents drinking and what I could steal and all that kind of thing. I don't know. I was drinking by the time I was in high school. I would run with the guys that drank and whatever all of that is. I don't know. I can tell you that I was no rocket scientist in high school. In those days, they used to give you a number as to when you graduated, what number you were in graduation academically for the number of people that graduated. We graduated 124 at Swiss Valley High School in 1954. And I graduated 118. So that's not really academic excellence, as I would define it. But anyhow, we would drink Fuzzy's dad's wine, and I would drink in the course of my parents drinking and all that kind of thing. And I was one of those kids that my allowance was the returning of the beer bottles. I don't know if you remember that or not. In those days, the little ones were 2 cents, and the quart ones were a nickel. And man, I'm going down to Toto's Hotel with two big brown bags full of empty bottles, and that's how I cashed in my money. That's what I ran with. That was my money. And when you got a whole case, 75 cents return on 24 bottles in a case if you didn't have any broken ones. And that was the allowance in an alcoholic family, in my alcoholic family. That's how you did it. And you get to good on pinball, and you get to meet all these strange people that your parents bring home, and it's just an incredible experience. If you haven't had it, when you go to bed tonight, get down on your knees and thank God that you didn't have that experience. Anyhow, I went to the military at age 18. Like a lot of young people in alcoholic families do, they get out as soon as they can. You know, and what I've learned since then, a lot of people leave families. And it isn't because they don't love their family, and a lot of the family members leave the alcoholic, not because they don't love the alcoholic, because they can't take anymore. They can't take anymore. It's too painful. So I did what a lot of people did. I left and I went to the Army, and God, I'll tell you, did I love the green beer in the Army? I was only 18 years of age, and I could now drink green beer, and I had never drank Coors beer in my life. And they transferred me from Fort Knox, Kentucky to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, and I got to drink Jack's beer and Pearl beer and Lone Star beer and Coors beer, and I loved it. And it was then, that was November the 18th, 1954, and I was a daily drinker, mostly beer, for the next 20 years until I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on October the 1st, 1974. And I slipped and I slid around Alcoholics Anonymous for about 27 months, and after that experience, I used to say, Jesus, Alcoholics Anonymous is wonderful. It turned me from a daily drinker into a periodic. And I didn't know what in the hell a periodic was. Well, I'll tell you, I learned when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A periodic of my experience is that you can hang in there and not drink for so long until it just keeps coming and coming and coming until you can't stay in your own skin 1 second longer. That's why, by the way, very seldom alcoholics go psychotic. Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they drink. That's what I did. And I knew a lot about this program, I thought. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came here through an intervention. They did an intervention on me. They called me into the workplace, and my boss said, if you don't do something about your drinking, you're out of here. And my bride at the time was sitting next to him, and then there was another person over here, a good friend of mine, and my ex-wife, Pat, said, Jeep, if you don't do something about your drinking, you're out of here. And then this other person, I forget exactly what was said there, but hey, I'll tell you what, most alcoholics that I know are very bright. When the heat's on, we'll comply. I complied. I went to treatment, but before I went to treatment, I want to share with you what happened. Because there's a lot of things that happened, and we don't have that much time, so I just want to share with you probably the best evidence of the progression of this illness for me. Was I, in this daily drinking episode, the interesting thing was that from a personal standpoint, from a career standpoint, I kept falling up. It's amazing, but that happens sometimes with alcoholics. I continue to fall up. And one of the problems with people that are alcoholics, if they continue to fall up, they have less and less people to be accountable to. I don't know about you, but I'll share with you what my father used to say. Like father, like son, right? The police would be at our house a lot. And so the police were coming up the steps one night, and my father has his Fruit of the Loom drawers on and his Fruit of the Loom shirt, you know. And this is back in what? In the late 40s, early 50s. So Fruit of the Loom's made a full circle, right? So he would stand there, and as they would be knocking on the door and say, this is the police, and I knew all the police. Frankie Russo and Buck McTiernan and a few. I mean, I knew all the police. We knew all the police because they were always at our house. Okay, Joe, open the door. My father's name was Joe, and he would in full command, if he could not slur his words, would say, "My house is my castle. You shall not enter." I say, "Come on, Joe, open the door." So if he wouldn't do it, I would run down, or Bob would run down, or my mother would run down. And they'd come in, and one more time, they'd put the cuffs on him and take Joe off to jail. The town was only 18,000 people, by the way. So if any time anybody was in jail, I knew who it was. The whole town knew who it was. One of the devastating things about this illness, if you're in a small town and you have a family that has the illness and your mother and father are bar drinkers, everybody knows. And if you're a kid trying to go to school, you can read what your friends are thinking. And you don't bring your friends home. And the whispers, you swear to God, every one of them are about you. If not about you, about your parents. And so most of my time growing up in that town was to sort of be something that could somehow balance craziness as I viewed what the people thought of my family. Really an interesting take, because for years, I remember saying this to my family. All I ever wanted was for you to be proud of me. Proud of my parents. So I did what a lot of people have this illness do. I began to excel in everything, but especially in athletics. Athletics was my bag. Put me on the practice field. If you wanted to find Jeep McDonald in all those years in Swissvale, Pennsylvania, you just check the basketball court, the football field, the baseball field, or the volleyball court. That's where you'd find me. I would spend hours. Did you ever do this with a ball, a rubber ball, or a tennis ball, and just throw it against the steps? You know that crack in the steps where you have to hit it absolutely perfect to get the bounce to come up every time so you could catch it and throw it right back so it would bounce? I used to drive my grandmother nuts. My grandmother lived with us too. With a baseball and a baseball glove. Bang, bang, bang. Hour after hour. So that was my ticket. That was my ticket. But I can remember, even when playing ball, that when my parents would show up, and specifically my father, I would know exactly where he was going to stand. He would never sit in the stands. He would be down around the fence near the end zone. And if he was standing up and not waving, my stomach was okay. If he was weaving, same feeling. And I could spot him from the time we come out of the clubhouse onto the football field. This is a night game, and I could pick him up immediately. That's alcoholism. That's devastation of alcoholism, of family and family members. So I went to the Army. What else could I do? And I love to drink, and I love to drink beer, and I didn't get in trouble very much, and I don't even know in the course of time whether I got into a lot of trouble. I got out of a lot of trouble, but I don't know how much I ever got really into. But I'm pretty sure about this. Most alcoholics, let me speak for myself. This alcoholic, when drinking, and certainly it's been a problem that I have to work on daily. And that is, I can be very grandiose. It's all into the ego. Very grandiose. Well, I saw a movie about 15 or 18 years ago, and the sequel to it just came out. It's amazing. Here I am, 17 years some sober. So I know it had to be 18 or 20 years ago, because I first got sober in 1974. It's called The Endless Summer. And I was fascinated with that movie. I decided at the Foxfire Room on Magnolia Boulevard in North Hollywood, California, at 9 o'clock in the morning, when I was drinking a beer with Chappie, who was the guy that cleans the bar. I met a lot of cleaning the bar guys in the course of my drinking. And I had this fantasy. My bride was working over at Pacific Bell Telephone in Burbank at the time, and I'm living in North Hollywood, and this is in North Hollywood on Magnolia. And I made a decision, like many alcoholics do, like this alcoholic did on the spur of the moment. I'm going for it. I'm going to go for my endless summer. I was supposed to be at work. I was an executive director of the YMCA. It was three streets down from the bar. And I jumped in the car, and I went to the bank, and I took the money from the bank. And I went home, and I left the car at home, and I packed all the suitcases I could possibly pack with all the clothes that I could possibly fit in those seven suitcases. I didn't take my car to the airport. I took a taxi cab to the airport. And I was on my way to Honolulu to look for the best beaches in the world, as in the endless summer. So I got to Honolulu, and, you know, I was drunk when I got to the airport. I was drunker when I got to Honolulu, and I found this hotel called the Circle Hotel, which was at the end of the strip in Waikiki. It's on the left-hand side. It's the first hotel that has an opening to the beach, and all of the surfboards are right there. And I knew that they were there because I had been in Honolulu before. So I went to the Circle Hotel, and that's where I hung up. And I was there for 8 days. And I never got across the street to the surfboards. Never got over there. Never got over there. And furthermore, I don't surf. And furthermore, I ain't a real great swimmer. But the grandiosity of wanting to hit all the beaches of the world, God, I can identify with that. And by this time in my drinking, I was down to what, at my favorite place on Western Avenue in San Pedro, California. I was now down to drinking for oblivion. I don't know if you've ever experienced this or not. And what this was, is that whenever I would start to, I couldn't even wait till 5 o'clock anymore. I would do insane things like this. I have a suit on. I'm the associate executive of one of the largest YMCAs in the South Bay area of Los Angeles. And I'm an athlete, first and foremost. I'm an athlete. By the way, I got to tell you the story about the athlete. When I was at the Youngstown, Ohio YMCA, I spent 17 years there. I was in youth work. Then I went to health and physical education. And I became the physical director. Then I became the director of health and physical education for the Central YMCA. Then the director of health and physical education for the metropolitan YMCAs of Youngstown. And in Youngstown, we had our own logo. We developed it ourselves. And I had a wonderful shirt, had our logo on it, Youngstown, Ohio YMCA. And I had a jacket, and it was all white with a blue trim and a blue trim up here. And it had Youngstown YMCA staff, Jeep. And I had blue pants with a white stripe. I had wigwam socks. And I had low cuts, Chuck Taylor tennis shoes. I mean, if there's anything in my life, you got to remember where I came from. I came from the bars of Swissvale, Pennsylvania. And for me to have an outfit like that, and me to be the director of health and physical education, have Chuck Taylor shoes that only the rich kids had where I grew up, I mean, that was a real accomplishment. Well, what you need to know about the insanity of this illness is it was Jimmy's place, was right across the street. And in the evening after the health and physical education classes were over and I had to close up the building, and that was at least twice a week, Tuesday and Thursday, and on the other shifts, it was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I would have to close up. I would run across the street to Jimmy's, go in the side door after I went out the back door of the lower gymnasium at the YMCA, through the alleyway, across the street, through the parking lot, and in the side door of Jimmy's, say, let me have a shot and a beer. Ancient age and a draft, whatever. And I would come back to that YMCA scared to death that someone would have a heart attack in a handball court, that there'd be a difficulty in the pool, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I would be absolutely paranoid. And in those days, we didn't have those things that we have today that you squeeze and it gives you new breath, mint, stuff out. The only thing that was available was Sensen. Sensen was in a little bag like this and has little licorice things. And, oh, God, I would put this Sensen in my mouth. And my mouth was all black from the Sensen. Man, where have you been? At any rate, in Honolulu, I then eventually, what happens, by the way, if you're a drinker like me, is that you can't drink all the time. Eventually, if you drink enough, you'll get so sick you won't be able to drink. And you'll have to get well before you drink again. And that's what happened with me. And I called home, and I can't tell you what my ex-wife said to me on the telephone, but I come home, and they said, you must go and do something about your drinking. That's how I went to treatment. That's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, what happened was I outfoxed myself. I did what they asked me to do, knowing that that wasn't what I wanted to do at all, but I would do it to get the heat off. And when I got there, I couldn't get out. It's like I just, well, the very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting I went to was at the Birch Street Tuesday night speakers meeting in Hawthorne, California, and Eddie C. was the speaker. Now, Eddie C. I identified with because he talked about zoot suits, and he talked about peg pants, and he talked about being cool, And he talked about, hey, what's happening, man? And hanging around the corners. And I could identify with that. And so I began to laugh. Now, what I want to say about laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous is, for me, the laughter of Alcoholics Anonymous is as healing as anything that I've experienced in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. The laughter in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was absolutely healing and a keep coming back phenomenon for me. And so I came for 9 months and I drank, and I came for 3 weeks and I drank, and I came for 2 days and I drank. And I was getting tired of getting sober and getting drunk and getting sober and getting drunk. But I did discover, as I shared with you, what the difference between a daily drinker and an alcoholic. And I had a sponsor who was a wonderful sponsor. And his children and I got very active in a number of sporting kinds of events. And then Hap passed away. And one of his sponsees, I asked to be my sponsor. And Alex is my sponsor to this very day. And most of what I experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous, not because Hap could not give that to me, but because for whatever reason I wasn't able to get it or wanting to get it or willing to get it. It began to happen whenever I began to hang out on a regular basis with Alec, who happened to be a person who, the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if I know of anybody who is as good with that book as Alex is in that book with me. And he took me through the steps yet another time. I mean a real time. The difference between my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous from October the 1st, 1974 to February the 13th, 1977 was the journey between the intellect and the heart. The journey between what I know and what I do. The journey between what I do and what my motive is. You know, interestingly enough, tonight, in today's reflection, is the seventh step. I am now willing and ready to have all defects removed. The seventh step, I was going to start a meeting one time called 3711. That's the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, and the 11th step prayer. I haven't got around to that yet. So if anybody thinks that's a good idea and you want to start a meeting, that might be... I'm going to do it someday. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. All these defects of character. I remember I used to talk to my sponsor about... Because basically, I get the religion stuff. Whenever I was still a Protestant at St. Anselm's Church, and those were the days when the church was open all the time, I used to deliver the Post-Gazette in the morning. I used to go by the church and open up the big door, and I'd say, hey, Jesus, this is Jeep, and shut the door and head on. Yeah, I did that. So I've always had a connection between there's something greater than myself, but the misconception that I had that I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous with me was, as long as I don't drink, no crap will come down in my life. Well, guess what? In 17 years, in 5 months and 9 days, I've had a lot of things happen in my life. But it was the same concept that I had whenever I was a kid, that if Jerry was a good boy, my parents wouldn't drink, that the craziness wouldn't continue, that this wouldn't continue or that wouldn't continue. So it was pretty normal that I would bring that concept to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I began to talk to my sponsor about what is this thing called spirituality. And he said, you know, we can talk a lot about it, we can get a lot of ideas, but let me tell you, probably the most spiritual words that you will ever utter, which would be my best explanation of spirituality in action, are really in two words. Jerry. Say. Are you ready for the words? Okay. Help me. Help me. I don't know what your experience is with asking for help, but one of the difficulties that I've had in the course of my recovery, that I really got a, I can remember saying this I don't know how many times in my drinking episodes. Maybe you said it too. And many times the people that I loved and cared about the most, that's who they say we hurt the most, by the way. It's been my experience. But here used to be my battle cry. I don't need you. I don't need anybody. Do you get that? I don't need you. I don't need anybody. Get out of here. Leave me alone. And if we continue to operate that way when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous and continue to operate that as we begin the journey or in the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous, we die. We die. So the most spiritual thing I can do about getting out of myself is to ask for help from the courageous men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and from a power greater than myself. We're getting close to wrap-up time, and I wanted to share an experience that I had 9 years, 11 months sober. 9 years, 11 months sober. Probably at about 9 years, 8 months sober, maybe nine. Because of a lot of problems that I had really generated myself. Here's what I found, by the way. Over all this experience, I generate about 94% of all of my problems come from me. The others are sort of curveballs that come in. Death and family, unexpected this, unexpected that, etc., etc. But most of it I create myself. Well, I was in one of these things that and I've now come to call them, and I'll explain this in a minute, attacks of alcoholism. So what I learned is, I learned this a long time ago, but I'll share with that experience with you that might be helpful to some, because it was helpful to me. The problem with this illness is not stopping drinking. The problem with this illness is staying stopped. My problem was not stopping drinking. My problem was I was miserable after I stopped. And I couldn't stay stopped. And so here I was at 9 years, 8 months sober. Things were going on, and I had some great things going on in my life, and I got ego into things. Here's the long and the short of it. I started to get into a depression. I am not a depressed person. Although my father was diagnosed as a manic depressive for years, ended up, as I shared with you before, years of psychiatry. And not once was he able to get a handle on his drinking. And here I was. I was getting depressed. I'm not a depressed person, blah, 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 blah. Long and the short of it is, I got into, all I want to do is watch television and smoke cigarettes. I love to smoke cigarettes. You know, I could put a cigarette in every orifice of my body and inhale at the same time. I would love it. I love nicotine. Anyhow, the long and the short of it is this. I got so sick. I didn't want to go to meetings. I didn't want to hear about your Alcoholics Anonymous. Bunch of crap. I didn't want to have anything to do with you people. 9 years, 8 months sober. People from my home group are coming, pulling me out of the door and all kind of stuff to go to meetings. And finally, I practically became immobile. And God sent me a gift. The gift was a treatment center back east that was working with alcoholics who were in difficulty in their abstinence and in their sobriety that had not returned to drinking or other mood-changing chemicals at that point. And I went into treatment 9 years, 11 months sober. I celebrated my 10th AA birthday in the treatment center as a patient. Wait till you hear the rest of it. And at that time, I was a director of an alcoholism treatment program. Knowledge is not enough. I equate that experience with having an attack of alcoholism. People who have this illness have attacks of alcoholism while they're sober. They don't have them while they're drunk. That's why they get drunk. And for some, it's more serious than others. We say this in AA all the time. Some are sicker than others. That's me. Some are sicker than others. Some have to go get outside help. Be quick to know that religious people or medicine people or psychology may be right. Don't write them all off. Be open. Open-mindedness, willingness, honesty. I went into treatment 9 years, 11 months sober, celebrated my 10th birthday in a treatment center. And I was able to stabilize and leave that treatment center and continue on in my life and in my activity in Alcoholics Anonymous and action. And it was after that, although I'd had some experience before that, that I became involved in service. If you are new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you're early in the journey, or wherever you may be, my experience, my most wonderful experiences of the 17 years have been when I was in service. So I ask you to consider service as a part of your Alcoholics Anonymous experience. And here I am, with beautiful people at a beautiful time in my life. Just 7 months ago, 8 months ago, I had to leave a job because they laid off a whole bunch of us, and I had been there 8 years. And it was sort of like a surprise thing, you know. It's devastating. Well, when alcoholics get devastated, I mean, they are devastated. But the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you keep coming around here, won't let you stay devastated long. Oh, they'll let you be devastated. They'll even help you to be a little more devastated. But they won't let you stay there. They won't let you stay there. They'll say, come hang out. Let's go hang out. Let's go coffee. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let's do NCCAA. Let's do general service. Let's do H&I. Let's do intergroup. How about getting involved in this group? And how about, and on and on and on and on and on. You see, I don't think there's anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that is not a bright person. I really believe that. I really believe that. So sometimes whenever I hear people say, and I certainly experienced this, although I don't think it's the rule for everybody, but I'll share with you a line that I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous that can sometimes describe me, is that when I'm in my head, I'm in enemy territory. When I'm in my head, I'm in enemy territory. That doesn't mean that I can't be bright. It doesn't mean that I can't problem solve. It doesn't mean that I can't face a problem head on and work through the problem with the help with a little help from my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. What it does mean for me is that action is the magic word. That I need to be in action, because it's sort of like sometimes my head is out to get me. It really is. And so I heard a line the other night that somebody said their head was trying to kill the rest of them and would have done it, but it needed their body for transportation. I thought that was pretty good. Anyhow, I want to thank each of you for being here and making a 12-step call on me. I don't know if I have been of any help to you. I always hope that I might touch one person whenever I share my story. If you're new, what they told me when I come in is, hang around long enough and someone's going to tell your story. Someone will tell your story. And so what happens with me is what I've learned from my sponsor time and time again. I did it with birthdays. Remember I told you I had a run of about 27 months. I couldn't put a year together. So whenever I had my first birthday, I didn't want to celebrate the birthday. That's ego. You know what my sponsor said to me? That's about as self-centered a decision as you could ever make. Shame on you. This birthday is not for you. It's for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous to demonstrate that it can be done. That even you can do it, Jerry, he would say. So I celebrate all my birthdays. And when I'm asked to share, I share. And what he's also said to me was that, Jerry, even if you don't touch a single person, I hope you will listen to what you have to say, because you may be the person who needs to hear it the most. And I think that's true. And so what I do want to say to you is that I do consider it an honor and a privilege to spend an hour with you, an hour and a half in the fellowship. And I hope if you come to the peninsula, you'll come to our group. And if you're ever in the area, even if you can't go to a meeting or we go to a different meeting, Jerry McDonald, I'm in the phone book in Pacific Grove, I'd love to at least share with you where meetings are and try to go to one with you if you get into town. So thank you and God bless.